Autre radio, autre culture, bonjour. Cette semaine, Autre radio, autre culture et Audio People sont allés au-devant des rencontres de la création sonore 2009 qui se sont déroulées à la SAE, School of Audio Engineering.
Wes Dooley, could you make the same kind of presentation, your story, how you started and when you started as an engineer, and then how do you it happened you serviced the ribbon microphones in Hollywood, and when and how did you start to build your own models, your own microphones?
Well, I started simply because I loved hanging out with musicians. I wasn't a musician, and I worked at a radio station at our college, and I started stealing the tape machine away at midnight when we went off and going over to the Troubadour, the Ice House, or the Ash Grove. Yeah. And the first thing I ever did was I had called and talked to the Clancy brothers and Tommy Makem, who were at the Troubadour. And I said, could I come over, you know, when you get done at 2 o'clock in the morning, and would you do me a half an hour radio set?
Oh.
And it was probably because I had an Irish name that they said, sure. And so I took, you know, this machine out, and it was now out of its case, and you could put your finger in and kill yourself, but I didn't know.
Which one was it?
An Ampex 350.
350.
And I had a roll of tape, and I had an EV664, and I put it on the stage, and I recorded them, and they knew mic technique, and they did a single mic thing, and that was my radio show. And of course, I was young and foolish. You know, I was probably 20 years old, and I said, okay, great. And then another week, I'd use that roll of tape for Mance Lipscomb, Texas Songster, or I'd use it for Lightning Hopkins, Blues Master.
Lightning Hopkins, Texas, too.
And, yeah, and I really loved this stuff, and I loved doing this radio show because girls would call it occasionally, you know. And this is all very cool stuff when you're 19, 20, 21 years old. But I used the same roll of tape for everything.
So I guess it was in the 50s?
No, this was, well, let me think about that. This would have been early 60s. Would have been Claremont, California. This would have been about 63 and 64, maybe 65 is when I was doing the radio show. Did it for about 3 years. And I met a guy at Caltech who'd built his own Ampex electronics, and he was matched to an Ampex deck, and it was a lovely machine. And I bought an Ampex 354 of my own, and we built a studio together and had a good time with it, and then he got his doctorate in high-energy theoretical particle physics and went off and worked on moonshots. And I stayed in audio because I didn't know better. And I was really lucky. I'd run into Wally Hyder at the Ice House, where I used to
Wally
take care
Hyder.
Of stuff.
And I've been to the studio, Wally Hyder studio in Hyde Street in San Francisco.
Yes. I walked through that when
Legend
it was
place.
Just a shell, and Wally and I walked through it. And we looked at the bank vaults down in the bottom and said, oh, echo chambers, this will be great. And I actually had a really good time because Wally would pay me money to load trucks, unload trucks, put mics up, stop, watch time things. I would have done it for free. And when we started, there was nothing but a rented bobtail, you know, truck that you had to lift the stuff up this high. And when you're 22, you can do that. And when it all ended and he was forced out by the Estrin brothers, he said, oh, we can make so much money for you, to the corporate owners, after he'd sold the company. And he sold the company because he said they offered him $500,000 in stock. And he knew that they were making all this money from rock and roll. But he knew this was a fad because the only really good music was big band music. And that's what he was an absolute master at. He would go across Europe following Stan Kenton, recording all his sets. And he just had it dialed. He knew the sound of big band. That was how he wound up the second day on the job. The the first recording job he ever had, he was working, as you probably know, at United Western on the Western side in the big studio. He had gotten an introduction to Bill Putnam. His children were in college and finished. His wife had died. He was a lawyer, but he was only a lawyer because his dad had told him to be, and he had a stutter. And what he loved to do and what he did was take his station wagon and record big bands, and he'd always give them the tape, and they knew him for being an absolute honest guy, so they let him keep a copy too.
Do you remember the mic setup and the kind of microphone they used to record big bands at the time?
Well, I remember that we used to put 44s and 77s across all of the saxes, all the brass.
All
now,
ruins.
I was.
Is that the reason why you are now doing these microphones?
Well, partially because I like to remember Wally Hyder and other mentors I had. John Sank, who was in charge of production at RCA from 60 to 76, who first showed me how to put a ribbon in a 44. And I went, wow, that's fiddly. That's like putting a meter movement back together, which I'd done, but I said, I'm not going to do a lot of this, but that's how you get it great. And people like Dick Heiser, who invented Teff and had a 44 that he measured and said, it has 30 kilohertz output. It goes out, it starts rolling around 10, but it's smooth. It still has output way out there. And Dick Rosmini, who, wonderful guitar player.
Can you spell his name?
Rosmini. Richard Rosmini. He was responsible for the Model 5 console, the 8x4 TAC Tascam console.
Oh.
He was responsible for the 80-8 half-inch 8-track. He was responsible for the Porta Studio. And he was the musician that TAC hired when a engineer who was they considered kind of on the outer edge had made some professional audio recorders at TAC. And they'd been picked up by TAC USA, who didn't know quite what to do with it, so they hired Richard. Richard was a wonderful graduate of Washington Square and all the guitar competitions there in Greenwich Village in the 50s. Would go out in the road and play behind the village people, all that sort of stuff, and got a contract with Columbia. And they put up something like an ELAM 251 in front of his guitar, and he heard the playback, and he went, this isn't anything like what's in my lap. He did not like it. And so he decided that he better teach himself how to record, because if he did, then he could hear his guitar played back the way he actually played it. And the setup that he taught me, that he learned for himself, because there weren't a lot of people to teach this, but he wound up with one 44, the one that had belonged before to Dick Heiser, who, when he died of cancer, Richard had wound up buying it from, arranged ahead of time, and in fact, Richard Rosmini died of ALS when I was in treatment for nasal pharyngeal cancer. You don't beat ALS, Lou Gehrig's disease. And I had arranged, I'd sold his mics for him, for he and his wife, and I'd arranged to buy this after he died. And I left it with him till he did. And then it was the mic that I took apart, put my calipers on, just because it made a really good meditation about Richard Heiser and Dick Rosmini, who were people who had been very kind to me, who had answered ignorant questions for years. I've been a member of the AES for 45 years, going to meetings. Dick Heiser had introduced me to the Sapphire Audio Group, which predated the AES, and had sponsored me for membership with that group. And so it turned out that was a very good sounding 44. It was the one that Richard would put in front of his guitar so it was up close, because you could have a big ribbon like that. It's very quick, but it's very well damped by the air because the ribbon weighs about the same as the air. And so it moves and then stops. So you can have fret noise. You can have finger noise, but yeah. It just sounds like being there. And when you sit right in front of a guitarist, that's a lovely sound.
Talking about an acoustic guitar.
Yeah. Well, I was raised up on acoustic instruments in the 50s and people who like to sit around and make music for themselves. And yes, we had people like Joan Baez who just were amazing. And I remember in high school when that record got to the campus, it was a Saturday that we could take all day and we sat there and listened to it over and over and over again and went, my Lord, is she good? You know, and later, of course, she found that she had borrowed some really excellent arrangements from a number of other people and made them her own. But she was so very good at it that after that, it was hers. And other people would say, oh, well, you're doing Joan's song. Well, actually, she lifted it from me. But yeah, I'm doing Joan's song. So I was just very lucky. I was hanging out with people who did acoustic music, be it folk, which was my interest, or big band, which was Wally Heider's interest. And Wally sold the business because he just knew that this rock and roll would go away and he better take the $500,000 when he could. And later did what he really enjoyed, which is he took Victory Discs, recordings of big bands that were recorded for the Armed Forces Radio Music Network in the 1940s during the war, World War I. He would transfer them to 30 IPS. Then he'd go through and remove all the ticks while preserving musical integrity because he cared passionately about this music. And then he issued them as Hindsight Records. And in a similar way, the reason that I'm going around talking about Ribbon Mics and all these people who, John Sank, Wally Heider, Dick Rosmini, Dick Heiser, is because these people are the reason that today we can do much better recording than we could then. And I like them to be remembered.
Okay, so your work is a tribute to these people.
That's basically it. I mean, I tell people...
It's kind of a moving thing, you know,
saying. For a long time, I do forensic work. I do forensic analysis of audio and video evidence. I do appraisals of things like when Leon Russell, you know, had a divorce a long time ago. I appraised the facilities in L.A. and in Nashville. More recently, David Foster. Things like... Universal buying A&M, our fantasy studios being sold by Concord Jazz. That allows me to do what I do on the microphone side. But gradually, it's gotten to the point where people go, oh, this thing you've been talking about for 30 years, there's actually something to it. And it's really a pleasure. And now people show up, let me talk to them. And let me tell them stories about people like, Bill Putnam, who, you know, were very kind and gave Wally his first job in the industry and told Stan Kenton the second day he was on the job, well, he hasn't been trained, but if you really insist, Stan, Wally can be your engineer. So the second day up, he was recording. Instead of a setup boy he was hired for, he was recording Stan Kenton. Wow. The only story I know like that.
Incredible. Well, that's kind of a great conclusion in a way. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
It's amazing.
Thank you, guys.
Amazing you. Perspective in the history of music. And your work is kind of a... We enjoy what you do. We all try to use what you do for our... recordings.
Well, as Joe Ciccarelli says, it's if you don't have long ribbons, short ribbons, big capsules, small capsules, and dynamics, you don't have enough flavors to get through digital mixes.
Great. Wonderful. Thanks, Wes. We'll be right back.
Autre radio, autre culture.